You're with The Regeneration, exploring how communities are changing the systems and stories we live by. This is independent media, free of ads and freely available, thanks to the support of listeners like you. So special thanks this week to Martin Pell, Simon Alston and Sue Walwork for becoming valued subscribers. If you too sense something worthwhile in all this, please consider joining Martin, Simon and Sue and a great community of supporting listeners. With as little as $3 a month, or whatever amount you can and want to contribute. You can get all sorts of benefits, including, of course, continuing to receive the podcast with transcripts every week. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support. Thanks a lot.
There are hundreds more of, you know, like thousands, millions of examples of things that work. And to be able to recognize that it's not that we have to be like practice quantum social change, but it is actually happening, whether we're aware or not. And to be able to see and tell those stories is essential.
G'day, my name's Anthony James, this is The Regeneration, and that was Professor Karen O'Brien, co-lyricist to the extraordinary music you're hearing. Karen is a globally renowned thought leader on climate change impacts and social transformation. She's been heavily involved in the work of the IPCC and shared in its 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. She's also been on the Scientific Advisory Board for Project Drawdown and is the co-founder of Sea Change, an Oslo-based company that has become a beacon in the space of social transformation. And a few months ago, Sea Change launched Karen's new book, You Matter More Than You Think, Quantum Social Change for a Thriving World. The byline reads, "Have we been underestimating our collective capacity for social change?" And spoiler alert, big time. Friend and best-selling author of Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation, Paul Hawken, says, "You Matter More Than You Think is more than just a book. It's an awakening, a how-to manual showing a new path to social and ecological regeneration." It feels like we hear the themes of this conversation in so many other conversations on this podcast, right up to the last couple of weeks. This also feels like a chapter two to the previous conversation Karen and I shared a few years ago. That's where you'll hear more about her fascinating background and what led her to her current passions, along with some early ruminations on what's become the new book. Here, we pick up the thread.
Hi.
Hello, Karen. How are you?
Good. How are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're crystal clear.
So you're actually getting out there, getting that, like the regeneration, the narratives are out there, which I think is super. Yeah. Like, yeah, we can talk about this, but I think it's so important to shift the narrative.
Yeah. Let's do bring that up at some stage.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Karen, we spoke 3 years ago, and wow, has so much happened in 3 years, hey? Including, of course, your book. I'm wondering, we talked a little bit 3 years ago about, I think this might have come out of talking about some of your experiences with students, but how indeed you experience the state of the world, if you will, on an emotional level, and you talk really frankly and openly then. I'm wondering how it is today, 3 years on, all that's gone under the bridge since. How are you feeling about the world and where things are at the moment?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think, like everybody, you know, it's just overwhelming to see, for example, climate impacts, to see the loss of biodiversity, to feel it is just a, it's a daily challenge. And I think to, you know, the emotional dimensions of it, as a researcher, it has to be kind of integrated into the research that we're doing, but also to recognize that, you know, like, wow, that we are in the decade that matters, and that what we do now is so important. So I go from, you know, just feeling like emotionally, like distraught, about what's going on, but also seeing that possibility and the potential for change, and realizing that, you know, the bar is quite low right now. So doing better doesn't take a lot of, that there's so much that we could do.
Mm, that's so interesting to hear that, because I've certainly caught myself of late, and, you know, our end of the stick, if you like, has been with the floods, just like constant flooding basically this year after, of course, bushfires that reached international media and plenty more besides, but I guess those are the cute edges. But even for myself at a local level, seeing the destruction of places that I love had me realized trying to cut off some feeling. And then I realized what went with that was all the feeling of the good stuff too. And and then reading your book was actually a beautiful point of practice of being able to stay open, and indeed a practice. And you talk about this in the book, practicing it. And I say that with reference to then some of my experiences of late that have been sort of documented, if you will, on the podcast, have been extraordinary on the level that you write about. But I guess for you, that's what it's like too. It's a practice to stay in what you know and believe to be more like how the world works.
Yeah, and I think it is that challenging, I try to put myself, or sometimes I ask my students, you know, put yourself in the future and look back and you know, what were we thinking back then in 2022? Mm. What was in our minds? What was the paradigm that was, and what were we missing? And so I'm always trying to just think about, what am I missing? You know, leave no stone unturned. If we really, you know, if we want to make a difference, not just for ourselves and others right now, but also in the future. And, but part of that is really, you know, taking in the losses, and there will be losses. And I think that's the, we see them every day, and, you know, you in Australia experience, you know, the magnitude of those. But when you read about the floods in Pakistan, about people working in fields within 50 degrees Celsius heat, you know, there's just, and the rivers drying up, it's so, it's very hard to hold, but to hold it, we have to, you know, because it is that is the space to move. Because I think many people don't realize the non-linearity of change, and that 1.1 degrees Celsius warming is really nothing compared to 1.5, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees. And so those differences in a systemic, you know, level of, you know, nonlinearity. And that's where I just think that the biggest adaptation we can do as a society really is to shift the way we think about it, and to recognize that we are changing systems. We are the systems that we're talking about.
Yeah. And the nonlinearity of time, of course, relates to the way we can change too. But let's come to that in a moment. Is there a particular practice that you invoke to be able to stay well and stay, I mean, we'll talk more about this, of course, but how the quality of agency that you talk a lot about in your book to be enacting that, is there a particular practices that you invoke for that?
Mm. Well, I have a whole array of practices, whether, maybe 9 or 10 years ago, I started with Vipassana meditation, and sometimes go off on silent retreats just to, kind of calm my nervous system and get that sense of, grounding in and also equanimity. But I do yoga, I run, I practice the piano. I just try to do things that, and I think, what I'm recognizing too is that I actually need a lot more time for that now, because the impacts are so, the challenges are so great, that, and I think that goes for everybody, is that to really hold on. We need community, we need self-care, and we need to really to be able to move forward. We have to be able to kind of ground ourselves in the moment and not get lost in the despondency and despair that is just the logical response to what we're seeing in the world.
Mm, logical, and certainly within the classical frame, isn't it, as you've talked about? All right, so I wonder if our launching pad can be what you did refer to in the book too, that there isn't a certain narrative out there that we are running out of time, perhaps even have run out of time. But you just mentioned the non-linearity of time when we take our cues from what we're learning in quantum physics. Could you talk to that a little bit about the non-linearity of time and how it relates to social change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think like we're often thinking in a very linear time. So we put things on a timeline, like the 2030 agenda for the Sustainable Development Goals. And, you know, we will reduce our emissions by 2050. And it's kind of as if, you know, we keep pushing things off into this future as if it's on this, you know, a linear line. And I think that, you know, when what you know, the future is right now, right here and now. And so to be able to like look from that quantum perspective, which includes like backward causation and, you know, really kind of is a whole different view of what time is, but recognizing that what we're doing right now is actually like creating that space for the, you know, what the future can be. And I, to me, that's like what quantum physics tells about time is very like mind blowing. And in the first draft of the book that I put out just on the, you know, for like maybe 800, 900 people downloaded, I had a chapter called Time Matters. And then I realized that like I got some feedback on it and it was just like, this is be above what, you know, like my comprehension. So I just kind of moved it into this decade matters. But I think it's fascinating, you know, and there's some people who have been writing about that, you know, like that nonlinear nature of time. But what it comes down to is that right now matters. And if we look at ourselves as processes, as, you know, collapsing a wave of potential in every moment, then it's like now and now and now and now. And that goes back to that practice of how do I actually, you know, like make that decision that is, that serves on behalf of the whole rather than just on, you know, myself. And so moving towards this, like creating these like fractals of change that can scale, I think is the most, you know, it's the most important thing we can do now. And it's also very challenging because we are reactionary. We are very, tied up with our own like ideas in our head of what is, you know, like right, wrong, and, you know, finding the fault in things. And so, yeah, to me, it's a continual practice and to step out of time for, you know, even just the, like that second. And that's why I think practice matters.
Okay. Let's delve a little more into some of that terminology. And I think maybe the best way to start could be with entanglement, which I guess by way of starting that, when you talked about there not being so much parts and wholes in the world as whole parts, like wholes and parts at the same time, it reminded me of Nora Bateson when she said, it's not so much an interconnected world. It's not so much that we have parts that we can sort of pick out. It's more like a soup. Try taking the salt out of the soup. You can't do it. So it reminded me of that as a metaphor for entanglement. Perhaps, Karen, let's start there to bring people in. I mean, I was happy to hear it. It bends your brain a little bit too. But to bring people in who haven't read the book yet as well, what we are coming to understand about ourselves and what I guess you're communicating from the world of quantum physics in hypothesizing about quantum social change.
Yeah, because I, you know, to me, it's fascinating because it is an inquiry, and it's kind of like, what if we are underestimating our collective capacity for social change, and non-local entanglement becomes then a really important phenomena and metaphor for looking at our intra-connections as part of a whole, you know, whole Earth, cosmos, whatever. And non-local entanglement refers to a phenomena where information about separated particles within a system is revealed when a measurement is made on one particle. So you know, like when you make a measurement on, you know, particle A, you know what particle B is. And that is, you know, it's what Einstein referred to as spooky action at a distance, but it really isn't any action. It's a correlation or co-relation. So it just shows that relational nature of ourselves and the world around us. And, you know, when we think of, you know, that happen, that's very effective. You know, it's real at the subatomic particle level, and scientists are measuring that over, you know, longer and longer distances and larger, like particles, even like small protons. proteins, but what it means in terms of social change. You know, some scientists are, our researchers are looking at language as a quantum phenomena where we're collapsing a wave of possible meanings into, you know, through our speech acts, through our listening. And so when you think about that entanglement through a field of language and meaning making, you know, we talk about, you know, wholes and parts, subjects and objects. And in the English language, we're really separating them as if they're very distinct. And I think we don't have that language. And that's why I think we have to just kind of bracket them and recognize that many other indigenous knowledge systems and you know, wisdom, there's other ways to express it through art, through, you know, poetry, through ways that don't make sense to our you know, like our rational minds. And so I think the entanglement part really is, you know, Karen Barad, whose work I draw on a lot in the book, you know, talks about our intra-actions and our, you know, agential realism, that, you know, we are actually like congealing, you know, our agency is this congealing of the material world into what it is. And if you look at what's happening in the world today, you see that, like, wow, we are actually creating a world that is, you know, it's a logical outcome of the thoughts that preceded it, the way we've organized society very, you know, into individualism, atomism, reductionism, determinism. And that's the challenge for us right now, is to step aside and say, like, wait a minute, where are we coming from? And where, you know, what does this mean for how I show up and what I do?
You related a little tale where of the firewalkers. Do you want to?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a nice way to communicate in, you know, real terms, quote unquote. Do you want to tell us that story?
Yeah, well, I think that the story of the firewalkers is a study that was done by some researchers of looking at the connection between, you know, people doing a firewalking exercise and some of the people watching it, and they could see that there was a correlation between in the nervous systems that was not informational. It was about, you know, like how it was, you know, whether it's mirror neurons or it's a non-causal type of thing, because the people watching were not actually, you know, walking on the fire, but they had the same physiological responses. And from my understanding of the study, and I think that just kind of shows that, you know, we are always influencing others, and what we do, how we are, is having these effects that, you know, we might be able, scientists might be able to measure it in that room or something, but we're having effects all over the world. And I think we feel that now too, with, you know, what's happening in other places actually affects us very much, both negatively and positively. And so it's more to think about how can we actually create those, the positive changes that are almost like off the radar from the way we're looking at the world right now.
Yeah, yeah. And therein lies so much more potential. So when you refer to non-locality, this is what you're talking about. And this, including with language, you know, as you referred to before, raises the prospect that literally everything we do, think, feel matters, which of course is the title of your book. And then that, I wonder, Karen, perhaps by way of juxtaposition, and you did just refer to it in your book slightly as well, you know how, I guess, the so-called New Age interpretation of this stuff and how that's been held up to dismiss a lot of this thinking over recent times. Is there part of that that you'd be distinguishing non-locality and entanglement from? Like, what should we be on the lookout for or how far should we go down the rabbit hole of thinking literally every thought, every word we come up with, every metaphor can be transformational? Potentially up against that sort of almost stereotypical New Age interpretation that says, you know, I can dream of a Porsche and it'll turn up in the carport. Mm-hmm. You've probably thought about this a lot, I imagine.
Yeah, because I think every time you put like quantum with anything but physics and biology and chemistry and information or computing or something, it's like, oh, that's woo-woo science. Mm. And so, you know, and I've been, of course, I've gotten a lot of reactions like, oh, what is this that you're talking about? Quantum social change. Don't put quantum and social together. Mm. But I do think that it's really worth thinking about that and not from this, you know, like, oh, we manifest what we think and everything, because that again is thinking of like consciousness as this, you know, like it's a very classical way of interpreting it, that I think this and then that happens in a causal way, when what non-local entanglement is saying in the collapse of the wave function, you know, Alexander Wendt, who's developed quantum social theory, you know, he thinks of consciousness as the collapse of the wave function into an experience. And so I think we need to just be very careful and also recognize that this doesn't negate classical physics, you know, and I, you know, I emphasize, or like again and again, that, you know, ice melts at certain temperatures, and we know that, you know, that like that warmer temperatures have influences on ecosystems, etc. So we really have to think about it. To me, it really draws attention to a lot of the things that have been said for centuries and millennia, and that social sciences and humanities are saying again and again about the importance of narrative, about the importance of our language, about the importance of emotions and experiences and consciousness and everything. So to me, it just widens the lens of what can be included in science. And physicists are the first to say that, you know, reality is not what it seems, and wow, we're in this amazing world. But when we get to the social, we tend to just assume that, like, oh, we are just these like almost like billiard balls that are just marching towards our own destruction, because we can't actually collectively work together and get out of our our socially constructed interests and hang-ups and shadows and all of that. So I just think that, wait a minute, there's a different quality of agency that can actually help us to work together in a different way. And that does mean that, you know, for people who just like, oh, I'm affecting the entire world, that's the very nature of climate change. What I do is influencing somebody on, you know, small island states, and also into, you know, well into the future, you know, for hundreds of years. So to understand myself as part of a system and to take responsibility, you know, having that ability to respond is so important. So when I see the, you know, floods in Pakistan and, you know, wildfires in Portugal or California, you know, I feel that, like, I am also responsible for that. And I also have a responsibility to do something about that. So it goes both ways. It's like, wow, I am the system that is actually responsible for this. I am the collective. And it goes very far away from our very individualistic, you know, like thinking of ourselves as very small, trivial, and the only thing I can do is, you know, like work on my carbon footprint and recycle and everything. It's like, oh no, there, I have a sphere of influence that is much wider than I think. And that's why I titled the book, You Matter More Than You Think, really literally, that it's much more than just our cognitive thinking, and, you know, can be interpreted in so many ways.
Yes. Yeah, it's a beautiful title for that. So even sustainability as that normative goal is secondary to this, and even change in that sense is, you know, even social change is in a sense secondary, well, in terms of it being an objective anyway, isn't it? So you're talking more about a way of being as a self-generator and self-repeater, and I guess that's where the idea of fractals comes into it as well.
Yeah, because I think it is that we're creating these patterns, you know, again and again, and what is that, you know, how do we shift patterns that are inequitable, unsustainable, and actually, you know, oppressive in many ways, and that's where I think we're at in the world right now, is like recognizing and seeing that these systems do not work for everyone, and many of them will work for no one at the end of the day, because it's really the, you know, the idea of winners and losers. The fact that we are all in this together is very clear, and at the same time we recognize that some people are, you know, just really on the edge, and that a half a degree of warming is dangerous climate change for many, and that, so, you know, how do we take, you know, increase our circle of care, I think. And to me, that's the, it goes beyond then just like sustainability as, you know, how do we just, you know, like maintain what is, but how do we actually really generate that world where all life can thrive? And to me, it is about like thinking differently, acting differently, doing things differently.
Yeah, let's bring in the narrative change that you've referred to and the language change a bit, as by way of then expanding how we think about changing ourselves, or perhaps even better said, healing ourselves, how you imagine the possibilities for change in those ways, and I guess the place of story, you know, all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's like so many different entry points for coming at change, but the power of words, the power of metaphors, the power of stories is one of them, because they kind of, you know, metaphors create our reality, and much of science is based on metaphors already. And so if we can be conscious about the language that we're using, is it a divisive language? Is it a, you know, like, because a lot of like our economics comes from our understanding of science, and, you know, we end up, you know, even for nature, you know, alien species and things that we draw on our understanding. Even quantum physics, the language they had for it was drawn from language that existed already. Mm. It wasn't then like creating a new thing, like quanta, you know, something, the small measurable packet of energy. And so to be able to, you know, like think about those entry points for shifting the story, shifting the narrative, where we go from like people as the problems to looking at people as the solutions, and from going into, you know, sustainability as you must do this and you must do that, turning people into objects to be changed on behalf of, you know, this or that, to the subjects of change based on what matters to them, and recognizing that, you know, we all are entangled, you know, as, you know, we all care about equity. We all care about, you know, you can't, even if you don't realize it, you know, like we are wired for our connections and for equity, as we can see that, you know, our brains are social, and that social part of our brain, it feels pain in the same places where we feel physical pain. Mm. And to me, that makes it very, you know, like there's so, it kind of widens the scope of what we need to do, whether we're talking about trauma healing, whether we're talking about, you know, how do we organize societies to take better care of young people, older people, that how do we transform our education systems to help create that sense of individual agency, collective agency, systems, you know, changing and things. So to me, that it just really opens up a whole different lens, not to do all different things, but to think about how can we do things in a different way, and, you know, a qualitative shift in our interventions.
Yeah, because so much of what I think, I guess probably generally, and certainly while I was reading your book, is, so we're 100 years or so into quantum physics being around. I think what keeps us in the classical paradigm when we're a century on from transcending that, not doing away with it, as you said, but transcending that. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is partly what you're touching on here is that we're still using the old language, the old metaphors, and we do need to change them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, science itself, it uses quantum physics as a, you know, a tool, as the, you know, the matrices, the algorithms, and it's the most successful scientific theory that we have. And when in the 1970s, the fundamental physics group in California got into consciousness and things, and it was like, it's a fascinating history of it that is, you know, like to talk about how they actually challenged the science and then came up with a lot of the things that are being used today for quantum encryption and quantum computing. And so they, the book is How the Hippies Saved Physics. And it is by,
I love that.
I'm just forgetting the name. Yeah. but it really is that, you know, like science has this, like, this is science and this is what it's due. And don't, you know, the social is something separate. And I think that when we start to look at science as social and put the subject back into science as, and recognize that the observer actually influences the measurement, that we are part of one system, then, you know, it opens up just different ways of looking at problems and a wider scope for looking at solutions.
Mm. I was so moved by some of your, I guess, talk of where people are changing the language and the narrative and those frames. And you talked about Tyson Yunkaporta, fellow Australian, obviously Indigenous Australian, mm-hmm. who wrote Sand Talk and has been on the podcast and comes up mm-hmm. a bit more too on the podcast, mm-hmm. and how he used in Sand Talk that pronoun that is familiar to him / them of us two, equivalent to mm-hmm. us two mm-hmm. together, a pronoun we don't have, obviously, with classical understandings in our language of separateness. And you mentioned other cases too, and I was very fond of, I sort of feel like I want to mention the Mayan exchange you brought up, because I spent time with the Maya in Guatemala. This exchange where it says, one person says, I'm another you, and the response is, you're another me. Lak ech alak in. I'll probably butcher it, but I'll give my best effort in homage to the people I was with back then. And you yourself in your book then go about, as you alluded to briefly earlier, using symbol and some of these conjunctions of nominally separate pronouns as we understand them. These are some of the... is it even right to call it play? Like some of the play or experimentation that you're inviting and encouraging as we try and create new forms of speaking, not just even new terms necessarily, just new forms of speaking and understanding and telling story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can see how challenging it is when, you know, all the discussions about people talking about pronouns and differently, what is the pronoun you want to be referred to by? And so when we start to change our own grammar, it's you know, it can be very challenging because we are wired, we have practiced speaking a certain way. And yet to, you know, there's something really beautiful, I think, about those examples you gave of, you know, to be able to see, you know, the other in you and you, that we are connected. And in our everyday classical world, we're always othering others, you know, people who don't share our worldviews or beliefs or, you know, that it's very easy to go like, who are these people? And forget that, you know, like, what is it that, you know, that brings us together as humanity? And, but also to recognize that the way that it's not just random, but it's about how we have organized society, our healthcare systems, our economic systems, social systems, that there's a, that we're producing the types of divisions that we're creating, and the fragmentation and the polarization isn't just something that, you know, just happens, but it's been fed by these narratives, whether in social media, whether on, you know, in on television, in stories and things, that we've almost been sold this idea that we are separate, that we are trivial, that, you know, like, just to not be able to think that. And I think that disempowers us when it comes to responding to issues like climate change and biodiversity loss and, you know, the ocean degradation and inequality, et cetera. So when, you know, when you look at it from this perspective, it really is like one big relationship problem. And that once we address one, you know, and climate change is my entry point, we have to address all of them, because you can't solve climate change or address it and have, you know, some people like lose it. You know, it can't be a world that is sustainable for some and not for others.
I love that. One big relationship problem. Which does allude to, again, what you briefly mentioned before, the trauma. So you've said that healing country and healing climate, if you like, is really about healing ourselves. And indeed, the foreword to your book then is really powerful, I think, and how it talked about, what were they, adverse childhood experiences, and that most adults, like significantly most adults, so most of us, and a good whack of children, half children, have experienced adverse childhood experiences, and that this matters. This is part of what keeps us, if you like, in the old paradigm, but part of them, what is the way out? It's a really important thing.
Yeah, I think it's essential, especially because we continue to traumatize people. You know, we have a war in Europe, we have COVID-19, we're not producing healthy human beings, and I think we all feel that right now. And there's so much work going on about trauma healing now, collective trauma, and so many, you know, people writing about this, really inspiring. And Christina Bethel, who works in public health at Johns Hopkins University, you know, she points out that it's not just about adverse childhood experiences, but positive childhood experiences can also have an amazing impact on that, on people's health. And so she's really looking at resilience, family resilience, community resilience. And that, I think, is where we have to, you know, really like get to the deeper human dimensions of the issue. If we want to solve, you know, if we want to be healing the planet, we have to heal ourselves at the same time. Because again, you know, we are nature. It's not separate from us. And how we treat nature. And I think that's where at some point we will just go like, maybe future generations will look back and go, wow, what were we doing? What were we thinking? How, you know, that's we look back and just think that there was a really, it was a really, like strange time that we're living in.
Yeah.
And so the nice thing about this time now is that, you know, so many people are, there's so many modalities for healing and so much information about it. So it's, the question then is, who is it accessible to? And how do we, you know, how do we integrate that into healthcare systems so that it is more like a healing systems rather than fix it in a very classical mechanistic way?
Yes, indeed. I think it was Christine talked about relational healing methods. that can interrupt traumatic impact. And then interestingly, a lot of that revolves around caring for other people and caring for children, that's what can heal our own stuff. There's a beautiful poetry in that. And I guess that's what you're saying overall. There's a beautiful poetry in how we're coming to understand social change in the context of how the world works.
Yeah. And I think the potentiality, is just such a, to me, that's a very powerful world, because it just shows that how, that there's, it might look like, oh, this is so improbable. We're going to be, having a 2.7 degree world. There's nothing we can do about it. But then it's like, no, the potential exists right here, right now. And it's in all of us, and it's a relational potential. It's about, it's about really unleashing that potential in everyone. And that means that it's not about reducing people to just that this is who you are and this is, and you are this way, but to see that what is that possibility, because everybody has a sphere of influence. And you can say at the small, what I do, my daily life, what I eat, what I shop for, what I don't shop for, all of that does have an influence. But we all have much wider spheres of influence, whether it's a football club, a church, a workplace, a city, that there are so many different places that we're intervening. And that's where getting to the fractals, that that if a quality of agency that really goes beyond the particular scale that we think we're in, to think of wow, this is this is affecting the whole.
It was so interesting how you talked about, instead of thinking scale out or scale up, to scale deep in that way.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes to, the researchers in sustainability science that have been pointing out scaling up, scaling out, scaling deep. Even some are saying scaling down. Huh. So in geography, we talk a lot about scale, place and space and things. Scale is a construction that we create, to make sense of that world. And what if we actually get rid of scale and just really look at ourselves as if that, what we do matters across those scales. I think you can see that I have to use scale to talk about scale.
Yes.
But that we are always influencing the whole parts.
Yeah. Yet that there's this sort of optimal range in a lovely sort of diagrammatic representation in powers of 10 between yourself and the global sphere. There is this sort of sweet spot you talked about, where it's between what you call communities and meta communities, sort of about the area you were just describing, sort of off the top of your head, wasn't it? Where it's nominally between 10,000 and 100,000 people.
Yeah, and that comes, the Power of 10 by Mark McCaffrey and Avit Bowman and his colleagues and things. And I think that's, that is the sweet spot for where we can reduce emissions the best and everything. And I think that when we put the individual into the picture, that, we are the sweet spot too, that we are, because we're engaging in those communities. We can engage at those levels and all of them. And I think every single one of us has that capacity to be influencing, not just ourselves, our families, our neighborhoods, our communities, our city, we're all in that. But I think if we want to look for solutions to global challenges, we have to be able to look at what they refer to as glocal. And Indra Adnan, whose work on fractal politics, she's talking about cosmo-local. It's not like this stacked hierarchy, but it's how do we actually impact those around us at bigger and bigger and bigger scales, until we're actually recognizing that we're impacting future generations as well.
Yeah. Well, that's the underlying premise, isn't it? That we're called to live in mattering more than we think. It's a call to heal and then live out values of oneness, if you like, the values that come with thinking that you are me and I am you. Living that out in every way we possibly can. And perhaps this is a nice place to bring in Karen, before I'd like to get to some actual practical observations of it too, but the superposition, that's an amazing frame. And for me, it was a real moment in the book where it sort of went clunk a little bit and I saw things differently in terms of the potentiality you talked about before, where we can be, all the ways we can be stuck in linear views of time and change. And this is a way of thinking about it that really, departs significantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole idea of like wave-particle duality in both and, that you can exist as both until a moment that you make a decision and a measure, you know, like you collapsed a reality into this or that. I think it is, you know, if we think of ourselves like always in these superpositions, we open up the possibility space, the potential for doing things differently. I don't have to always react the same way or choose the same things or decide this or that. I can actually, it really is that getting to that like multi-layered, you know, like these properties can exist at the same time, but we only in our perceptions, we only can, you know, have information about one part of it then and not the other. And so being able to move toward that both and perspective is, I think like that's a really important step for us as a species right now, to go away from the either or, right, wrong, and everything, to see like that, being able to hold that paradox. And much of this, you know, the book and a lot of the thinking, this is really an inquiry, because we don't know, you know, like there's so many interpretations of quantum physics, and we haven't explained it. We can use it. We can, you know, talk about it and, you know, the wonders of it. But the explanation of like, what is the nature of reality is still this, you know, like a big question and a mystery that probably science itself cannot answer, you know, give a definitive answer. And so it's to me, it's that like just to be able to open our minds to thinking of ourselves as part of the world that we are generating. And at this, you know, when I start with the decade that matters, that it really is, you know, like I said the same thing 10 years ago, we're in the decade that matters, and yes. I probably will say the same thing in 10 years from now.
Hopefully we're here,
but the science is telling us, when we're looking at like, you know, potential tipping points in terms of ice sheet melting and permafrost and ocean circulations, it's like we actually, you know, like we have to take this seriously. And that's where I think I was so compelled to write this book, even though I was like, it took a lot out of me just to try to make sense of what is this. And I really had to search for, you know, like how do you make sense of this from a very, like, to convince myself that yes, you matter more than you think was part of it. Because you know, it really, it's probably the most important message we can give people right now, is that, you know, every action matters and you matter, and so yeah, you're part of this.
Yeah, and paradoxically, to the classical mind, this can actually generate, in not thinking of urgent outcomes or whatever, can actually generate faster change.
Yeah, because I think I talk about in the book, you know, like from Dr. Monica Sharma, who I've been working with on these, you know, the three spheres of transformation, you know, she talks about urgency, you know, like you can take the seriousness of urgency, but not the stress of urgency. Because when we respond urgently, we're likely to then just kind of go for the most logical, like, let's just do geoengineering, or let's, you know, like that we go away from, you know, we create more problems than we solve. And so being able to relax and see from what is the best move right here, right now. And, you know, for me in practice, people always say like, what does this actually mean? Mm. And to me, it does make me more aware. And when I'm walking down the street, I just look at people and say, oh, you matter. Look at trees, you matter, and, and everything. But also recognizing that, okay, if I decide to, you know, it's raining out, should I, you know, like drive or walk or take the bus or things like that, that those decisions matter too. They are influencing the whole. And so it's not just trivial. And then making me more thoughtful about what I do, why I do it, and what are those impacts, and how could I have the biggest impact. And often it's not just about doing those things, but it's about the conversations we have about them. And that's where, you know, being able to talk without othering people or turning them into objects or saying you should or you have to, but really recognizing like what is important for us all right now. And I think digging deeper is really essential right now, and then seeing also like wider, you know, so the wider and deeper solutions are what we need.
Yeah, there was a podcast you had recently with, was it Paloma Pavel on the Cities and Societies podcast? And you talked about, I mean, you had practical examples in your book too, but these ones really stood out to me that she brought to the table that relate to this, don't they? There was one that, interestingly, there was a line in there, I can't remember if you or she said it, proceed at the speed of trust.
That was Paloma's, yeah.
That line was said in our federal parliament with our new independent female MP. out of the revolution that really occurred, or at least the start of one in Australia in May, I think it was, earlier this year with the federal election, that changed our parliament, elected 7 or 8 new independent, all women from around the country, and our seat was one of them. She used that in her first speech in parliament. So I don't know where she picked it up, but it'd be interesting if you had different sources too. It would sort of reinforce the point, wouldn't it, that it just things like that, those that value set, things said and done in that value set spread. But she had some great stories to tell about actual experiences in cities. One was San Francisco, one was New York. Did any of that really grip you, or are there other stories that have really gripped you in ways that this has played out?
Well, I think like Paloma Pavel's work in communities, you know, at the front lines of climate change, you know, they just show that potential. They just show the possibilities kind of, and she has a model of, you know, like of how, like a compass for how to work with those. And to me, that and looking into there are hundreds more of, you know, like thousands, millions of examples of things that work. And to be able to recognize that it's not that we have to be like practice quantum social change, but it is actually happening, whether we're aware or not. And to be able to see and tell those stories is essential. And to me, like to have those conversations, and that's one reason I wrote the book also, to generate conversations, to open up an inquiry, to see how we could take what already is being, you know, in place and you know, kind of shine a spotlight on it and say, yes, and here is, you know, this happening. And also then being aware of where they fail, where power, politics, interests, you know, where we get divisions. And, you know, because I think that to be, you know, within that, the political sphere, there's people who are very much averse to change, you know, changes in the status quo. And so to be able to work skillfully, collectively for that, it's not just about like going against and, you know, pushing against, but it's like, how do we shift those conversations? How do we shift the narrative? How do we actually disrupt those dynamics that are actually killing us?
Yeah. I was so taken when Paloma talked about the San Franciscan example, that the academic that had come into their community processes was sort of bailed up and said, okay, first step, you come and meet the elders. It's all about what you just talked about. And that recurred in all these other stories, and that they ended up having extraordinary successes in these cases at some scale. Like, you're talking about significant transport budget in San Francisco. That was that case. Mm-hmm. And she said they were all transformed in the process. And indeed, we're seeing this in Australia. I had a recent episode with a woman who's working with communities who have been coal-producing communities in transition. And very similar themes, practices, outcomes in the making. You're right. The stories are everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah. And that non-locality is there.
The non-locality is there, yeah. But not everyone's accessing those stories, are they? Are there not enough tellers of the stories, or do we need to do something more there, or just more of us jump in?
Yeah, I think that more people need to tell that story. And we see from social media that you know, social media kind of highlights the negative, the ones that go against. And it's not the, you know, the beautiful stories, and the news in general doesn't highlight the positive story, although there is a movement towards constructive journalism and telling positive stories. So I think that's a really important thing. But how do we, you know, share the, I think sharing the ideas of what, because often we just think, oh, we're just so alone. This is one little case in San Francisco or in Perth or, you know, here or there. And we don't realize that it's a, like this entangled web of actions taking place around the world. And if we, and again, it goes to like that just by the mainstream narrative is actually forcing us to underestimate our capacity. And in the book, I also point out, you know, drawing on the work of Paulo Freire in Pedagogy of the Oppressed and Pedagogy of Hope, that, you know, there unity and power of people can be very dangerous. And yet, you know, that power has to be grounded in equality of, you know, in the values that apply to the whole, because a powerful people that, you know, can be just oppressively powerful also and fragment the world and, you know, destroy species, destroy the climate, et cetera. So it's important that we really think about, you know, how we can actually change that that narrative, just to bring it down to the values that matter for all of us.
Yeah, you're touching on my old Latin American days there, Karen, with Paolo. That really, those texts are on my shelf, well battered. Mm-hmm. Before we wind up, Karen, I wonder, do we need, well, I guess you've said in a way we need more processes. I'm conscious that your transformational leadership course continues, and you've had a 2022 community involved in that, I believe. And has that continued to be revelatory in these kinds of ways? And should we look at doing more of that too?
Yeah, no, these are these courses really are about putting putting the quantum social change into practice. And, you know, by looking at like kind of like the tools and templates that we need to strategically design for systems change, that produces results. But it is about, you know, like who I am, how I show up, and, you know, how do I create that kind of fractal quality of agency so that I can, you know, whatever my outcomes and ideas are. So, you know, what I've been, you know, I've done them for 5 times now, and I learn every single time, you know, to improve my, you know, deep listening and speaking responsibly and, you know, getting beyond my background conversations, but also thinking about, okay, what needs to shift? Because often we talk about transformation as, you know, it becomes a blah, blah, blah word, but, yes, you know, what are we actually talking about shifting, you know, from this very, you know, reductionist, polarizing perspective to one that is more unifying, that one that, you know, that sees and recognizes that potential. How do we shift power structures? How do we, and what's been really inspiring is seeing just how it hits people when they show up and in the, you know, very first session on, you know, what is important for me and for all life, you know, that is like, speaking from that stand, you suddenly open up a very powerful space for engaging in the, you know, political and the practical spheres. And see, you know, to me, it's been, you know, so inspiring to also to see just how people can get it very quickly and shift things. You know, their projects. Everyone comes in with a project or a breakthrough initiative. And that potential there, those tools, you know, that it's not like voodoo science or anything, but it comes from like the neurosciences, it comes from language theory, it comes from everything that, you know, that we've been talking, you know, like about in science. That so it's not you know, it's not difficult, but it takes courage to show up.
And we talked about the Sea Challenge project last time too, so I'll leave people to listen to that for the in-depth explanation of what it is, but you were just going more public with it outside of the school context. And then COVID came, of course, but I'm wondering, will you be persisting? Have you been persisting with that?
Yeah, we've been persisting it, especially in schools, but now, like, but trying to really build it into this, what I would call like a You Matter movement. Because doing an experiment with change for 30 days, just as an object, you know, look at it, explore it from the practical, political, and personal dimensions, is such a powerful way to think about, you know, how do I disrupt patterns? How do I establish new ones? How do I engage in different conversations about change? Because when it's an experiment, people are much more open to talking about, like, oh, why, you know, why are you eating a plant-based diet? Oh, why are you, you know, why are you picking up trash? Why are you doing this? And yes, you generate those conversations, and then you hear stories from your neighbors about, you know, local foods or things. And it just is a much more inviting than me going out and saying, like, I am reducing my carbon footprint and you should too.
Yeah.
And because that makes people feel like guilty. And then you right away start like, oh, why should I do this when oil company, you know, the governments are still investing in oil. And then you start to, you know, the point of these experiments really is to start to, you know, to think differently about change. And I see it as a really strong entry point for all the other work that we're doing, and, you know, that as an entry point for quantum social change and mattering.
Big time. Yep. And this does feel a bit like a chapter two of the book of our conversations, Karen. And there's more detail on all that in the chapter one for those listening here today. Now, you might remember we talked about music when we closed that last conversation, as I do every conversation, and you've said music is at the heart of quantum social change, and for that matter, the arts in general. And I have to say, I mean, my wife even picked up your book yesterday because she's looking forward to her turn, which she gets now. I get to hand it over. The artwork is unbelievable. And for that matter, the whole production has a beauty to it. So you know that, I know, I can feel that you and the artist, and for that matter, even the designer, are again enacting and embodying what we're talking about in the very project. So as a segue to what piece of music you would take us out with or describe to our listeners in this conversation, Karen, what comes to mind or has come to mind of late that has moved you?
Yeah, I think that linking the art and the music, my collaboration with Tone Bjordam on the art, you know, during the COVID time was just a wonderful experience because she could express, you know, we had these dialogues about, you know, consciousness matters and what that would look like. And it was just such a great back and forth. And, the music that, you know, sitting during COVID and working on this book, my son is in a band and called The Eternal Page. And
beautiful.
And he had a song called Wildflower Meadow. And I still, like, I could just listen to it over and over again because it just kind of resonates with exactly what I'm thinking about in terms of quantum social change. And I told that to Tone and she just, you know, like drew a beautiful wildflower meadow with bees and, you know, flowers and everything. And so I'm just thinking about that creative possibility that there's opening up to, you know, like you just see the joy that my son and his friends get of is making music and putting it out there and that creativity. And so, you know, I guess the segue would be like that, you know, music matters and creativity matters, you know, like I, and, you know, we had a, during the COVID webinars about what matters. And I think it is the resonance that we create with other people is, and that is like, it is almost like that, how do we create a new type of symphony for social change?
Yes. Well, you're talking about certainly my personal ultimate experience of everything we're talking about, though perhaps it's being rivaled now, actually, which is with all this, basically, but was in a band and with a very much, I mean, you talk in the book too about the jazz of physics. And how improv is a bit of an analogy for this stuff too. And and really, you know, you commune around that and you listen and you open to where someone's going next. And that's not negated. You build on that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had to have a chuckle too because I remember you chose a Creedence Clearwater Revival song last time. And and I went and checked out The Eternal Page on Spotify and it had very similar overtones. So he's not fallen far from the tree.
Yeah, he's very much like 60s psychedelic rock inspired.
So am I. Awesome. That's great, Karen. Well, I'll leave you to your lecture's preparations, hey, and thank you once again. It's been wonderful, and thanks for your book.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to talk to you again, and I look forward to future conversations with you as well.
That was Professor Karen O'Brien, the globally renowned author of You Matter More Than You Think, Quantum Social Change for a Thriving World. For more on Karen, the book, and some of the other things we talked about here, see the links in our program details. And if you'd like to hear our previous conversation on the podcast, head to episode 42. And a quick update on the December tour of another previous podcast guest, Zach Bush. The Byron Bay event has already sold out, I'm told, and events in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne are also selling fast. For those interested, you can find details on the Regeneration website. I'm looking forward to seeing some of you over there soon. And that's with thanks, as always, to the generous supporters who've helped make this episode possible. If you're enjoying what you hear, please consider joining this community of supporting listeners so I can keep the podcast going. Just head to the website via the show notes, regeneration.com/support. Thanks again. And if you feel like it, share this episode with someone you know who you think might like it. I'll leave you with Wildflower Meadow by The Eternal Page. My name's Anthony James. Thanks for listening.